of 1944 as summer help in the college library. 44 and summer 44, summer 45, I spent doing that. I graduated from college and came back for a year because the then librarian thought I would make a good librarian and said, work here for a year and we'll switch you in all the departments of the library so you know whether you like it or not. So we did, and I did. And I went on to Columbia for a year and would have been happy to come back, but he had better sense than that and said, you really need to get experience someplace else. And so I was lucky enough to get a job at Colgate, and which is far enough away from home to be away from home, mm-hmm. and yet close enough. As it turned out, I did have to come back 4 years later because my mother was ill. But close enough to home that I could get in and out if I had to, by a Greyhound bus, because I did not have to drive a car. But so I had 4 years at Colgate, and then I came back here. As I guess the term would be professional. Theoretically, it was I had faculty status, but not rank. Now, that would be awfully hard to prove and awfully hard to define, and it was sort of a weasel way out of it. They didn't quite know what to do with women who had any kind of training other than secretarial. So, 44, 45, student help doing whatever they wanted, and then the 46 through 47, trying everything in the library, and then I came back in 52 as an assistant cataloger.
Wow.
So, yeah.
That's interesting. So you started off as an assistant librarian?
No, I started off as an assistant cataloger.
Oh.
The person in those days, it was cards.
Uh-huh.
Okay, I was the one who took the book and either made up the cards if we didn't have them or checked the cards and changed them and worried about whether people were filing cards properly and subject headings and all the sort of thing that now they're thesauri, do you suppose, or thesauruses, whichever. It's a whole different world. On the technical part of the library.
Yeah.
And I suspect at the time, I'd had the reference course at Columbia, and I liked it, but it was mostly answering questions, and I've always loved to answer questions. I don't want to write the paper, but I love to find the answers to the questions. And so I was assistant cataloger at Colgate for 4 years, so I'd had some experience. But I didn't start doing any kind of reference work at UNI until another 2 years. And at that point, the same librarian believed that reference librarians ought to have cataloging experience so they'd know what they were dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
This can be a sore point with librarians. Some agree, some don't. But at that point, they shifted the men librarians did have faculty rank and status, which was annoying.
Because
mm-hmm. I thought I was smarter than they were, and I think I was. But anyhow, so then I started doing reference work. Some reference work, and then shifted back and forth. And when we went into the new building, the woman who had been the head cataloger and assistant librarian, her husband retired from the faculty, and they moved out of the area. And so I became the assistant librarian at that point, and that was in 1961.
Wow.
So, 60-61 in there, yeah. So, that's an interesting thing if you're interested in this business of women. She was the head cataloger, came here from, I don't know, somewhere in the South. She'd gone to the library school in Nashville and ended up marrying the man who was head of the geology department. And she should have waited a little longer because they never could get her salary up to where it should be for her experience and her responsibilities, because she was married to a faculty member who was and a full professor. And so that kept the rest of the library down, because the head librarian did not want to make anybody paid more than she was. And of course, then there was none of this faculty salary promotion and tenure bit. It was all in what they used to call Dr. Davidson's little black book. And I never saw the little black book, but it was a somewhat patriarchal and certainly could be guilty of favoritism system of promotion. I mean, he would go around and call the various heads of the departments and ask, if somebody was up for tenure or just even a simple reappointment, should they be reappointed, and the department would say yay, nay, and that would be it.
Wow.
You know, so things are, they're more complicated now, and one hopes fairer.
Wow. Can you tell me, what you remember about UNI when you first got here?
Well, of course it was. it depends which is first. If you think 44, it was war B-12s were here, and the poor civilian students were much outnumbered and I think felt completely ignored. I don't think they were, but that's how they felt, because mm-hmm. they were so outnumbered. So that was not a normal, well, nothing was normal. It was not a normal college. When I came back to work full-time, is it going?
Yeah, it is.
Okay. In 46, 47, it was when the first bulge of veterans hit. Mm-hmm. And I was here in September. Columbia didn't start until later, and I was here for the registration, and we had to wait to do it to help with registration until they'd all gotten up in the gym because they were sleeping on the running track of the old gym. There wasn't a place to put everybody.
Oh, my God.
So it was crowded. And at that point, they had to build after I was gone, they built an addition over in what's now the Alphabet parking lot that had space for books and for students. And they studied there because it was hard to find any place to live in town at all. If you were married, you could live in Dutchman's Village, which is about where the field house is now. And it was army housing, and it would take your family. You were pretty crowded. There were one bedrooms and two bedrooms, I think, as I remember. It was all kerosene, you know, space heater and ice boxes. And people had to be told how to empty the tray under the ice box when the water melted.
Because
you couldn't buy that kind of consumer goods at that point. So it was crowded. Same thing at Colgate, because I was there for the rest of that 4 years, and they had one, and it was called Vetville. The same sort of thing, the same conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And they had Colgate, of course, more so, at least I remember Colgate better at that point, but I suspect the same thing was true here. A lot of the secretarial help and the aides and what have you, the lab technicians, if they had the training, were veterans' wives. And there was even something called the Veterans Wives Club. And I always, every time I see that now, I think of, were they veteran wives or were they wives of veterans? So,
I know, really. Play on words. So what was it like being in an all-male campus? I mean, working here, all-male campus.
Well, of course, my difficulty was being a cataloger. I was in the back most of the time. And I don't know whether they thought I could be convinced to help some of the young men more than they needed help if I were out front. And that may have been one reason I did not do reference work right away. I don't know. I think I probably would have been a little shy about it
mm-hmm.
because I'd gone to an all-girls school.
Mm-hmm.
It was fun. And I'm just trying to think. It's hard to get back to how you felt when you were 25
yeah.
and 26. I enjoyed it. The one thing I do remember, this may not make much sense to anybody now, was when I went to high school over in Knott Terrace because I lived in Schenectady.
Okay.
Yeah. And I remember the sorority I belonged to at the time, one of the girls was coming to a college prom. So this would have been probably in 41, before the war started, probably spring of 41. And she was moaning and crying, and the rest of us were green with envy, and she was going to a college prom. And she said, oh, but I'm so worried. I'm so worried because of all those smooth college girls. Well, you know, I suppose that's something to think about. Well, when I came back, I didn't date anybody here during the war, but I came back and I met some people and I was having a very good time. I remember the first dance I went to, I was thinking the same thing because I was 2 years, 3 years out of college and, oh, all those smooth college girls. But it was different. In those days, they did have the big dances.
Mm-hmm.
They did have, the young men were supposed to move out of the fraternity houses. I'm not quite sure where they were supposed to go. And the young ladies took over, and then they always had people chaperoning. But on the other hand, I remember, because I lived at home, and I was not about to stay overnight. My mother and father would not have left me at the age of 25, you know. And I remember hearing one of the house press in this particular house say to the chaperone, who was a youngish person, but married, so that meant they could be a chaperone, but be sure you knock on the door before you go in.
Now, were the chaperones women, or did they marry?
Usually married couples.
Oh, couples.
Sometimes faculty wives. It had to be couples. You had to have a woman involved. And then we've got some lovely pictures over in the archives. I don't know which fraternity it was in the 1920s, and believe me, you wouldn't dare step out of line seeing some of those women. I don't know when they stopped having chaperones. Probably in the 60s.
Mm.
Because I think it was more they had enlisted, but I'm not sure that anybody did very much because they were getting younger chaperones.
Yeah.
So you could get married couples that were veterans. I mean, you had the man had to be out of school. He couldn't be chaperoning his peers. Right. But that didn't take very long, you know. So that was a whole, and they always listed in the Concordia for the very big weekends who was coming for each of the houses.
Oh, really?
Where she was from. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You read that very, no matter what. We were always curious.
This is the dates or the chaperones?
The dates. The chaperones were listed too, but the dates.
Oh, wow.
But not whose date you were.
Yeah.
Your name and where you were from.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Right straight down to all of the trains.
Like an RSVP.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think the greatest change I remember, well, I didn't notice, but if somebody did, was Hale House used to be an open place for lunch. Anybody could go in there and eat. And I suspect also for dining. I didn't stay down. The younger male faculty members in the 50s used to eat dinner there. But this was later than that. This was after we became co-ed. And I remember one student saying, well, I had lunch in Hale House today. And I said, well, how was the food? He said, it wasn't the food. The whole glee club from Wheaton came in, and nobody looked up. They were so used to seeing women now
gosh.
That it was not a strange thing.
That's amazing.
Well, you know, it was different. Because I remember when I was in college, it was all girls, all women. We're not to use the phrase girls. But it was all women. And if anybody had a date who was brave enough to come into the dining room, there were smaller dining rooms, small, 80 people.
Mm-hmm.
But you could always hear that one long male voice under the going on up above. And I suspect the same thing would have been true here had anybody gone to dinner or that sort of thing in the fraternities. It would have been one voice up here and rumble down below. But that's what he meant. People did not notice. We had a young reference librarian who had what he called the reader interest quotient, and I don't know how it worked, whether 1 or 10 was the highest. But when he was doing reference, if anybody interesting came in, he had to look up, literally, legally, to see if, you know, questions were asked. And I'm obviously sexist now, but in that day, they were just interested in the young ladies and whether the reader interest quotient was high or low. But the highest quotient was the day the man came in, President Davidson came in. I was outside then. Nobody looked up. He was followed by some distinguished-looking gentleman. Yeah, nobody did. I mean, they may have looked up, but they went right back to their reading. But the thing that really caught their eye was a liveried chauffeur carrying a box of books. They all looked up. They hadn't seen that before. And I mean, that was quite true. You had to be, I worked here, so they didn't pay that much attention to me. It was part of the Golden Oak furniture in the library. I think probably the young women who worked in the other offices may have been more aware. I'm just trying to think back then.
Were there a lot of other women around the campus?
There were more women around the campus than there had been.
Mm-hmm.
The registrar and the recorder were both women. One was married to a union alumnus from the class of 1920-something-something, and the other had a nephew who was going here. But by that stage, in my mind, they were motherly types, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The one was married and had no children, the other did not marry, but was obviously being a good aunt to the various kids. I'm just trying to think. The president's secretary has been a woman for a long time. I suspect the greatest concentration of women in one department would have been in the library, because there were two catalogers and a couple of typists in the cataloging department, and the secretary and the person who checked in the periodicals, and the circulation librarian. But the reference librarians were male, and well, one of them at least was a proctor, lived in the dormitory.
Uh-huh.
The other one lived up in Bentville, and he didn't last long, thank the good Lord. Weird young man. But there was something forming at that point called the Women's Staff Association. I think they now just call it the Staff Association. But there were clear, if unstated, divisions. Because this same woman who was head of the cataloging department said to me at one point, well, if you want to, I think Mrs. Sayre, who was another faculty wife, and I can get you into the faculty women's club if you really want. We can work and get you in. And I thought, you too. And said, if it takes that much, I'm not interested.
Right.
Because I thought, this is ridiculous. I mean, I was mad personally. I was not mad for womankind as a whole.
Yeah.
I was just plain mad. If it was a supposed to be married to a faculty member? Fine, I wasn't.
It was a little likelihood that I would be.
But if it was for the faculty, theoretically I had status, if not rank, I should have been admitted immediately. So I said, no, forget it. I'm not going to get involved in that. But that was a particularly difficult position. I mean, not difficult. And I had ambivalent feelings about it because I was perfectly willing to work. The pay wasn't that good. I had to be home anyhow. But it annoyed me.
Mm-hmm.
It annoyed me that I say it was not any great feminist anything.
Yes.
And as a matter of fact, I was back at Smith when Betty Friedan's book, The Feminine Mystique, came out. And they, I don't know if they still do or not, but they had something on February 22nd called Rally Day. It would be like takeoff, what was takeoff day here in the 50s. And it was called The Feminine Mistake. So they worked everything else in. But that was sort of an indication of how at that point they felt about Betty, who was a Smith alum, and what she was up to. I couldn't tell you a thing about it, but I just thought it was interesting that college with that background would use that as a theme for their faculty takeoff, which is anything.
Yes.
But just The Feminine Mistake, I thought that was. But as I said, that's 10 years after I was here. And people were beginning to worry about things like that.
So what was the role of the faculty wives? Did they have a
I know somebody is doing, Mrs. Mattis, who was a faculty wife and came in 47 to 48. So they'll, and she's good. She's a very aware person. And they had, well, it was social. I mean, the other things were not provided for. There wasn't a dean of students. There was the dean of faculty. Dean, period. I suppose he was dean of faculty, but he wasn't dean of students. There was a director of student activities who did it half-time. For a while, it was Mr. Ketz, who was full-time director of athletics. And for a time, when he came back, Joe Finkelstein, Professor Finkelstein was. But it was never a big thing. I mean, they made sure that the Concordia paid its bills, that the Idol got published, that the contracts were legal for the various dances, that sort of thing. But for anything beyond that, no. There were practice in the dorms. They didn't get into any kind of counseling until the late 40s.
Mm-hmm.
But the Faculty Women's Club provided things like on the Sunday of when freshmen came, they made sure they provided the coffee and donuts down, and once it was a West College, they provided coffee and donuts down in West College. For themselves, they always gave a spoon to the new children, I mean, when the children were born. They had other activities, but since I had said no, as much as I know, but I mean, that was the sort of thing they did. They also provided, I don't know if they did anything at commencement or not, but they also had a big party at Christmas time, usually in the president's house. And they provided, it was not the president's wife's responsibility, obviously she was there and keeping an eye on things, but the Faculty Women's Club did the organizing, made sure they had the punch bowls. They had a silver set that they owned. Two, both coffee and tea, and a whole set, because of the way people's minds worked in those days, they had china that they had bought, cups and saucers, and those were kept under lock and key up in the upper level of Hale House, and if you wanted them, you had to, I know you had to write it out, but you certainly had to sign when you took them, and you had to, somebody checked you when you brought them back to make sure they were clean, so that the next person wouldn't have to wash them off. And when the Faculty Women's Club finally disbanded, and it had to call a meeting from one of its so-called, they didn't use it, but I would say now a daughter group, which was called Minerva Crafts. I mean, people got more interested in other things. The whole world was changing.
Right.
And so did union. It took it a little longer in some cases. But we had to call people from that meeting so we'd have a quorum to dissolve the Faculty Women's Club, because by then it had been called the Faculty Wives Club. Then they made it Faculty Women because they had to admit that they had at least three people who were faculty.
Uh-huh.
And by that point, I had an appointment, theoretically, in the history department. So that that's why at that point I became a member of the Faculty Women's Club. Faculty Wives Club was what it was before, though. And, oh Lord, I am wandering. So I don't know what else they did, but it was a social...
They were very present
on campus, yes. They had, at one point, they had a reception in Hale House to raise money for the scholarship fund. This was in the 30s, and they had the Audubons there, the big elephant folio Audubon that the college owns, four volumes, all 435 prints, yeah. And they had it there, and people paid, I don't know what, but I mean, that was a fundraising thing for the scholarship fund, and I'm sure they did that sort of thing. But people were just not that interested as we got further into the 60s. And I say, when you have to call people from another group to provide a quorum so that you can legally do this. Oh, I know where I was getting. Ann Seaman, who was librarian before Barbara Jones. I mean, Dave Garin was the librarian between Ann and Barbara. But Ann came here as a faculty wife and was a member of the faculty wives and faculty women's club, and joined the faculty on the library. And when it closed, she said, "You know what I'm going to do?" And I said, "What?" She said, "I'm going to go buy some of those cups and saucers." Just, and I said, "Oh, Ann, let me know. You know, I'll be happy to go." She said, "I'm going over this afternoon." So I now have a cup and saucer.
Really?
Women's club.
That's so neat, though. That's such a nice article to take away.
Well, I just think we couldn't take the silver.
Right.
The silver went to the president's house. But, and there, as a matter of fact, one piece managed to get lost the last day before Tom Bonnet was here. They think the moving van people either took it or not, didn't realize what it was. It was in the housekeeper said it was upside down in the sink draining because they had used it for lunch. But by the time we came to count the silver, there was no teapot. So it's now missing one of these teapots. But I said we should have signed in and out for that too.
Yeah.
But there is not that need for the faculty women. Well, there's a need for the faculty women, yes, but I mean for the faculty wives, no.
Uh-huh.
Because most faculty wives, well, the first thing they had to do was change when they started really hiring women, was to change the personnel form because it would say wife's maiden name. So then they had changed that to spouse. So, but anyway, small things like that along the way, and they finally got around to it.
So did the wives turn to the women, the faculty
mm-hmm.
women club?
Mm-hmm.
Did that evolve into something else?
No,
still
no. As far as I know, it doesn't. You see, the thing you've got to remember, and I've got to be remembering, is that I haven't actually worked on the campus 4 or 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what the groups are now. There have been various, the President's Commission on the Status of Women was Mr. Bonner's, I think his then wife's doing, because she had worked at colleges and knew there were problems. He wasn't a stupid man. What was he? He had his problems, let me put it that way. But that was from 74 to 78. And by then, the women had been on campus as students, as undergraduates. We had women on campus as extension students, evening division students.
Oh,
yeah. Oh, and long.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Well, since I can remember. I think they were finally, the first time they were admitted was sometime in the 1920s. But people got their degrees. Sally Van Skoik, who would be a great one to interview, except she's so mad at the college now, she probably wouldn't help. She got her degree here, and I think she was probably the first one to do it. This was before women were regularly undergraduates. We had them coming in all the time. I mean, it was one young woman. Most cases, they were people who had interrupted their education to get married, the war, one thing or another, and they were now at a point where they could resume education. This was handy. They didn't want to go to Albany, or they could afford to come to Union. I don't know which the difference was. We had one young woman who used to come in. She'd been at Stanford, and she was finishing up here. And so she used to come into the library with the baby during his nap period. He'd be one of those large carrying bassinets, and they'd stick him under the desk and do her work. And when he woke up, she left. People, they want their education. They're going to get it.
Yeah.
But that was how they were doing it in those days until 1970. And in 1970, the library was the only building that was really equipped for, quote, females, unquote, on campus, because then we had been built in 1961, and we were well aware of the fact that you needed plumbing. This sounds weird, but that was one thing that they had not much thought about when they were building all these various places on campus, because when we were in the Mount Memorial, which was the library, that had plumbing. I don't know when they put it in, but somewhere along the line. And the poor young woman who was his part-time secretary for the geology department, which is part of Old Chapel, or above Old Chapel, there was no plumbing there. And that poor gal had to come across the campus every day and use the giant library.
Oh, my God.
So that they were, and we stayed open on commencement. I mean, obviously it was fun to stay open. It was a smaller school. The people who had worked as students, as student employees, or whom you'd known would come in and see you and all that sort of thing. But we kept it open because it was the easiest place to reach for plumbing for females. I mean, Hale House had some, but it wasn't always open during, it was open at commencement, but Alpha Delta doesn't have anything. I mean, if you were affiliated with the fraternity, fine. But you know, for the big parade on the Saturday before commencement, you couldn't always get to the places you were affiliated with. But we had plumbing, and so when they started designing the dormitories after 1970, they had sense enough to put plumbing in and air sinks and all the rest of it.
Okay.
You know. But before that, they didn't, and so they had, that was one problem they had, was having to put ladies' rooms, women's rooms, whatever, in the various buildings to make sure they could, they were, and then of course with the laws on accessibility and disabled, we had to put one more in the library. But, you know.
So how was the transition between, you know, going co-educational?
I think it was a lot harder on the older faculty members. I know some of them had to clean up their jokes, or they should have.
Yes.
Some of them were just plain uncomfortable teaching women because they never taught women. They got over it, I think. The thing that annoyed me when they were talking about this business was that they said, well, the women are all going to go to the languages and literature. And I said, don't be silly. Well, they're not going to go to math and sciences. And I said, yes, they are. I said, I wouldn't myself, but it would be drawing card, you can't put this in the admission ad, but try your engineering. If you don't like it, you can change,
mm-hmm.
and you don't have the stigma of having, quote, failed,
yep.
that you would have if you'd gone to a strictly technical school.
Yes.
It's the great balance. And so about 3 years later, the first woman winner of the Bailey Prize was an engineer. I was so happy.
Right? Yeah. Oh,
I may be a little wrong on that, but I mean, I was annoyed. But they were downplaying it to that extent. Now, whether they had had statistics from other schools and that's what they found, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But there aren't very many schools our size that have the engineering, good engineering component, plus the other.
Yes.
And I don't know why people picked, why women would pick to come to union.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there are people who are still on, alums who are still unhappy, but they're probably unhappy with everything.
Yeah. You know. Really. Did they have any sort of, you know, the first years of co-education, did they have any sort of groups or, like, you know, just to help the women get oriented in this all-male school? Do you know what I mean?
I know what you mean. I don't know. I honestly don't remember. Isn't that awful? And so it didn't affect us that much because we'd always had people coming in. We didn't have to change our jokes. You know, and it was the library, of course, was probably female-dominated. Not, I mean, we had, the head librarian was a man,
mm-hmm.
but, just trying to think, was 70 through 74, 75.
Right, did you hear anything through the library, you know, I don't want to say gossip, but just like stories about how things were going, whether
there were
the wrong
I remember. I remember going to one meeting, and I can't think what it was. It may have been just before the Faculty Women's Club died, and they were, and it may have been the forerunner of the President's Commission on the Status of Women. But I remember there were some young women were complaining because they felt they were being unfairly treated, and I suspect they were right. But there were two others sitting beside me, and I was young enough that I could still get down on the floor and get up without embarrassing myself. And I heard one day, well, I don't know what college she's going to, because she said, I'm not having that kind of problem. And her friend said, I agree with you. So there was a split in how people perceived the treatment they were getting. Now, whether they were all in the same class, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that was probably a fairly good indicator that some were unhappy, and probably with reason. Others weren't unhappy. They were happy they picked it. They were happy with what they were getting. Now, whether they were less perceptive than the group that was unhappy, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can't put myself back in that time, and I probably wouldn't have known what was going on if I had. I know some of the students were not happy with it. And I was very surprised that it had passed the faculty as easily as it had, because there were a number of important and probably influential faculty members who did not really want to teach women.
Mm.
But when it came to a vote, it passed. And I think it was something like 3/4. I'd have to go back and check.
Yeah,
I mean, it was not a 52-48.
Yeah.
No, it was a resounding majority.
Okay.
So whether they saw the handwriting on the wall that most small colleges were not going to exist unless they became co-ed,
mm-hmm.
I don't know. At that point, we were busy trying to build the wing on the library, and the head librarian was doing a lot of the planning with the donor, Mr. Schaefer. And so I was busy running the library, and I was not on that many committees. So I can't tell you. I do remember this exchange, these two young women beside me who were behind somebody's couch. I don't know where this meeting was. Maybe in the old staff lounge, something like that. But this one was very unhappy, and these two, one looking for her, saying, well, I don't know where she's going to college, and she's having that trouble. So what all was involved, I couldn't tell you.
Did you see the atmosphere at the school change at all? With girls coming, you know, in terms of, was it more social? It
was a different kind of social. The social before, as I said, had been like the big dances. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know what went on during the week, probably not too much. But everybody got ready for the weekend because people would come for the big dances. Obviously, they'd come for more than Skidmore. But there used to be those horrible things called mixers.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd bring in truckloads. And it was sort of like my feeling, watching it or hearing about it, it was sort of like a cattle show, you know? I mean, miserable.
No idea.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you one thing. The atmosphere changed. I don't think anyone was publishing. What was the book that came out through the 50s? And I think by the 60s it stopped publishing. It was called For Men Lonely. And it was a guide to the various women's colleges in the area and where they were and how you got there and bus or train, or if you happen to have a car. And the places to go and the things to do. But I mean, it was a semi-commercial publication that went on for 2 or 3 years anyhow. There was an indication that that was how people found people, or you came to college with names of friends who had friends, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think they have mixers anymore, do they?
No.
That's good.
Yeah.
But I mean, that was one of the things that both Skidmore and Union would provide, so that you could get to know people. You did feel a little like it was a cattle drive. That's why the young man saying that the whole wheat and chorus had walked through and nobody had looked up was a big change.
Yes.
It became normal to have women around.
Yes. So when it became co-educational, was it more directed toward like fraternity parties as it is now, or was it still more dancing?
Well, 70 through 73, 74 was a very rough time because it was the time of all the Vietnam protests. So that the social would have been more, and I'm guessing here, would have been more outwardly social. I mean, it would have been social concerns, Vietnam War, pro and con. And you didn't hear much about fraternity parties. In fact, I thought about that point, fraternities were going to sort of die on the vine. They were all having problems with meeting their finances. I guess maybe they still are. But given that sort of social consciousness, you didn't want to be emphasizing differences.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's about somewhere in all along in that area, and I'd have to go back and check. I'm helping with the Dictionary of College History, and I'm trying to keep a timeline straight in my mind, but I'm not sure about this, but somewhere between the 60s and the 70s, there had been two Jewish fraternities up on Lenox Road, and flourishing. They were all bright students.
Mm-hmm.
And that they were beginning to have trouble meeting their expenses. And so I don't know whether it was the National of Kappa Nu that merged with Phi Sigma Delta, but somewhere along the line they merged and the college took over that house. And then Phi Sigma Delta merged with something else which merged with Zeta Beta Tau? Zeta Beta Tau. And that house came back to the college. I mean, you see, when you start losing that sort of thing, I think those were the two main ones. Now, in 67, they've been having problems. It's all about in through there. Because that's the time when they took down Phi Gamma and Beta and Kappa Alpha. Kappa Alpha came down because they were planning the Science Center over here.
Uh-huh.
And that was along in that. Kappa Alpha is about where the idol is now.
Uh-huh.
And Phi Gamma is where the road goes out to Union Avenue.
Uh-huh.
And Beta was along Union Avenue, and if you walk down there, you can see there was a gate that used to go in, and that was taken. I mean, they've closed it, but I mean, there was a gate
over by Davidson?
No. From Gillespie Street down to the main gate.
Okay.
They were in there. Again, that was finances, and they had, in the meantime, they were building the Fox and Davidson at that point, and they moved them all into there, I think. I'm not quite sure where they all ended up. But, I mean, that was not, fraternities were not a big thing. They either couldn't fight or wouldn't fight, except for DU, which is now a checkered career here anyhow. But then there was a resurgence after that. Because they had to do something. I think they got a dean of students for women. Or dean of women students, I'm not quite sure. You'd have to go back and look at the concordies for this period, and I would too, to be safe.
Mm-hmm.
But they did at least make that effort. They had a dean of women students, and they also, where along the line they made sure that they had a gynecologist on call, I don't know.
Uh-huh.
But I know that was a problem.
Uh-huh.
Because mostly what they had done, they had an infirmary, but mostly what it had been sports injuries. Or measles or something like that sort. But I mean, for preventive medicine, I don't think they'd been doing very much.
Mm-hmm.
But then they were making sure they had that possibility. I mean, these are things, my guess is nobody thought about them ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
If they did, I certainly didn't hear about it until it hit the Concordia or faculty meetings, you know,
yeah.
What was going on.
Right, right.
And I was very surprised when they started sororities.
Mm-hmm.
I can see why they're needed. I had done my sorority being in high school. And of course, I went to a school that didn't have sororities. It had what they called social houses, which were probably more tightly woven than a sorority would ever be. But I wasn't that kind of social.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know, I mean,
yeah.
For sure. I was surprised that they, but I can see why. And I think it was a banding together, probably, so you would feel you had someone to talk to.
Yeah.
You know, I was surprised because at that point, the whole business, everybody was trying to be, well, Students for a Democratic Society,
mm-hmm,
you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, it's interesting that I hadn't thought about it before, that we took that we became co-ed at that time. Whether it had been, if it had been earlier or later, whether it had been different, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't
know. Yeah. Did you talk to any of the, I realize that you were, you know, in the library, but did you ever have any contact with any of the first women students, other than those two that were sitting next to you? Do you know what I mean?
No, not really. Except unless they worked in the library.
Uh-huh.
I do know that the woman who was the valedictorian in 72 was extremely unpopular with the men in her class because she had transferred in from Cornell. And they were annoyed that she was her grades from Cornell were accepted along, and so they were not happy with her. But there were things in the Concordia, and Paula this, Paula that. Paula wanted to be a lawyer. I'm just trying to think of the ones when they started to work in the library. They were good. We had one young woman I know that was here, but this was in the mid-70s, and decided she would pledge a sorority and went to the first thing and de-pledged. But she figured it wasn't what she wanted, but by then, I think the need was not the same. By then, they were more established, and you felt, I would have to ask somebody who was a student.
Yeah.
You know, to be sure, and I don't know, I don't remember any of it. There's only one I remember in town. Only one I know who was here in town, she might be willing to talk to somebody. I don't know. I'll have to get her married name, call her mother and find out what her married name is. That's going to be embarrassing. No, I'll use the alumni directory and find out.
Yeah.
Now, I can't help you that much because, as I said, we've had women in the library working, sometimes student wives during the first part of it, and when we went co-ed, we had women as well as men.
Hmm. Yeah. So what do you think were some of the most difficult things that, you know, male and female students had to overcome, had to adjust to here?
I suspect it depended what kind of school they'd gone to before. Once we got past those who had been here when it was all male, which would be probably the class of 73, maybe 74, the people who had come in as a co-ed class. Now, I don't know how many of the young men had accepted union thinking it was going to be an all-men school and therefore felt cheated.
Right.
I couldn't tell you that. But there may have been some of that. But it was the ones who had been here who felt, I suspect they didn't like the competition or thought they were not going to like the competition. They were happy to have the women around, but not for what the women wanted to be around for, is my guess. I'm just trying to think. What I knew at that point. I think it was just plain being here. You know, it didn't matter whether they were attractive, non-attractive,
yes.
Downright dowdy. They were being here and they were taking up space that the gentleman, quote unquote, thought was theirs.
Do you think that the academic structure changed at all? Or the academic environment? Do you know what I mean?
Well, I think it probably became somewhat more competitive. Now, I have not been in a class, a co-ed class. I did sit in on a couple of seminars, and I took Greek about 10 years ago, But that's a small class, so it's hard to say. I mean, it's not the kind of class where you're going to volunteer or not volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
The professor asks you to recite the alphabet, you're going to
right.
recite the alphabet, you know. So I don't know how it is in those classes. Everything you read seems to say that the women are less likely to volunteer, and if they do volunteer, they're less likely to be acknowledged. Now, whether that's true in college or not, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I just plain don't know. But my feeling would just be that if you'd gone to either an all-girls high school or prep school, I don't think there are any of those anymore either, are there?
Yeah.
Well,
MMA yeah.
is still all girls, isn't it?
There's a couple.
But if you'd gone one of those and you suddenly got here, you might have a small problem. But that was a problem people had if they went to co-ed schools anyhow.
Mm-hmm.
But mostly I suspect the private schools didn't feed into the co-ed schools. They fed into the single-sex colleges. I don't know. I'm not helpful on that because I just plain don't know.
Yeah. do you think that the women have changed over the years? I mean, you know, given the trends of change
mm-hmm.
and that, do you think that the clientele of women who come to Union College has changed over the years?
No, it's hard to tell in the library because you see only a certain percentage, and that's a percentage if they're asking questions. They want information. They may not want knowledge or wisdom, but they certainly want information.
Right.
But it's I would say they were coming in more self-assured and maybe with less reason. Does that sound sensible?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure does. Yeah.
Can we move over so you don't get the sun in your eyes? I thought it was going to move the other way, but it didn't. How are we doing?
Looking good. As opposed to when it first became co-educational,
mm-hmm.
do you think the relationship between men and women has changed?
It sounds to me like it's more relaxed. And I don't mean relaxed in any bad sense. I mean, it's just normal. You're a friend.
Yeah.
More like siblings. Of course, siblings fight.
Yeah.
But much less, I don't know. My feeling would be when I see people greet each other and everybody seems very, very friendly, I think people are much more relaxed about their relationships now. How far that relaxation goes in their social life, I don't know. It's not my business.
Mm-hmm.
I do know we've had several, well, at least when I was here, there was at least one case of date rape because I knew the young woman. And if she said she was raped, she was raped.
Did they pursue it?
They pursued it for a while, but they couldn't get too much. But I mean, it was enough was going on that I think people were frightened enough, both male and female, to be sensible, quote and unquote.
Mm-hmm.
How long that lasted, I don't know, but I do remember that one. And so that was one of the women who worked in the library, and I take her word for it.
Mm-hmm.
She was not. As a matter of fact, I wonder why she had gone to the party in the first place, knowing the reputation of that particular fraternity. If I knew the reputation, I would have assumed somebody 25, 30 years younger than I might have known it, but
yeah.
That's something else again.